When are you? So when have you decided that your general manager sucks? When is the time that you've decided that, you know what, the team has been woefully mismanaged. We don't like this guy anymore. What is he doing? Yada, yada, yada. Because I'm trying to figure out exactly how much good faith is built up for GMs of winning teams. I'm thinking about that today because there was some points of debate about Peter Chiarelli and the Boston Bruins with the return of Johnny Boychuk to Boston today. You know, Boychuk obviously is a casualty both of the salary cap this season and subsequent seasons. He's going to be unrestricted this summer. Gets sent to the New York Islanders. There was eight defensemen on the roster for the Boston Bruins. Boychuk was decided to be the one that was expendable. The Bruins obviously needed to keep their heads above the cap. They got $3 million in cap space, $3.7 million according to CapGeek right now, which allows them a little bit of flexibility later in the season. And so Boychuk had to go. They have 11 players under contract, according to CapGeek, for next season. Gregory Campbell, Riley Smith, Daniel Paille, Karl Soderberg, all need contracts. Adam McQuaid, Torrey Krug, Matt Barkowski, Dougie Hamilton, all need contracts. And then looming after that is Milan Lucic, Louis Erickson, the darling Chris Kelly, darling of the Boston media. Point is that there's a lot of contracts on the horizon both next year and in the following years, and she really has some heavy lifting to do to get all those guys in. So the question then becomes, how much blame should he get for the cap predicament they're in now? And I don't know. I mean, the Krejci contract got a lot of grief, 7.2 in 2015, 2016. That's when it starts. But again, that's what he would have gotten on the open market. Patrice Bergeron's undervalued, and he signed in perpetuity at 6.5 through 2022. It's a good deal. But you look around this league at the teams that are successful and the teams that are facing cap issues. I mean, Chicago is facing massive cap issues, but I don't think anyone said it's Stan Bowman's doing a bad job. Kenny Holland, not necessarily facing mad cap issues, but a guy who, because of the cycle of quasi-rebuilding Detroit's going into, has been, you know, called out for not being able to maintain and sustain this team. So when's a GM of a good team come under fire? Does it take missing the playoffs? Is it like a coach where a coach all of a sudden becomes a bad coach if things don't work right and you miss the playoffs? There's an amazing amount of job security for GMs, isn't there? I was just thinking about that today in writing about Ovechkin and Glenn Hillie's stupid-ass comments about him last night on Sportsnet, and the fact that he's now played for five coaches, but he's only had two GMs. And thinking about the Devils after I saw Lamoriello in The Rock the other night, and the fact he's been there since '87. There's a lot of job security for general managers in this league, and I think part of it is that it does take a few seasons of poor play, bad hockey. It does take a full-on rebuild sometimes to kind of get them in the crosshairs. It takes more than it does for anybody else, a player, a coach, or anything, to get a GM pushed out of a job. Part of it is because a GM has cover. A GM can simply say, as Brian Burke used to say in Toronto all the time, "All right, I got a five-year plan. Don't worry about us. We got a five-year plan. You can't judge us based on 2 years. We got a five-year plan. And no trades during Christmas." It's an easy out for these guys to simply say, you know, "Don't change horses in midstream. You all have a plan," yada, yada, yada. But I've referenced this site a couple of times already during this opening, and I'll do it again. How much did life change for these guys when CapGeek came around? You can use NHL.com to evaluate the performance of a player. You can use NHL.com to evaluate the performance of a coach. The team stats on NHL.com are revelatory in many ways, as far as how a coach does his job. Now we got fancy stats that tell us exactly how a coach does his job based on where he is putting his talent on the ice to start a shift or end a shift. You can evaluate a coach and you can evaluate a player through the stats, but when CapGeek came along, oh boy, did that change the game for GMs. Now we see in front of our eyes every single day how much everybody's making. And despite people like Glenn Healy saying it's the player's fault for signing a large contract, at the end of the day, it's the owner and the general manager that are giving that player the contract to sign. There are no guns to the head in this league. So every day we can log on to CapGeek and see exactly how a GM has done and will do. We can see contracts that stretch past 2020. We can see how these contracts compare to similar players around the league. It was a game changer, dude. It was a game changer in the sense that now GMs can be more readily and specifically criticized for how they've built teams or failed to do so. Now, is Chiarelli in trouble? I don't think so. He got torched a little bit today because a good player like Boychuk had to go because of some cap issues. But I mean, you know, when you've built a talented team, as Chiarelli has undoubtedly done in Boston, as Bowman's undoubtedly done in Chicago, you're going to lose some players. I don't know how Lombardi's done it in L.A., to be honest with you. I mean, copious amounts of Kool-Aid being drunk there to keep that team together as long as they have and will continue to with the contracts he's gotten those guys in under. But for most teams, you build a great team, you have to make tough decisions. And in Boston's case, vis-a-vis Boychuk, I mean, it's obviously the rise of Dougie Hamilton, the rise of Torrey Krug, Barkowski pushing for time. He probably wasn't going to come back anyway, so the loose fruit falls from the tree all the way down to the Islanders. And again, like I wrote about this morning on Puck Daddy, it's early. I'm not trying to do anything but talk about what's happening. Not trying to say the Islanders are going to win the Cup. Wasn't trying to say Rick Nash is going to win the Rocket Richard in the story yesterday. But you look at the difference on this team with Boychuk, and you can't help but stand up and applaud Garth Snow for making it happen. He brings a physicality, a 110% dedication to work ethic on every shift, which is more important than rings in the room. We talked about rings in the room yesterday, me and Merrick. Merrick, by the way, not here today, because you couldn't wonder. His mic is not malfunctioning, by the way. He's not here today. We talked about rings in the room yesterday, but like, it's so much more important to not only have a guy that's won and not only have a guy that comes from a prestige organization like Boychuk does, but have a guy who just sets the bar as far as work ethic goes. And Boychuk does on every shift. But the biggest change so far, he's getting over 4 minutes of power play time a game with the Islanders. 5 of the 6 points he has in 6 games have come on the power play. You know what his ice time was on the power play last season for Boston? 18 seconds a game. Because he's sitting behind Chara, Krug, Hamilton in the queue to get power play time. So the apple falls from the tree. Garth Snow picks it up, takes a chomp, puts him on the power play, and all of a sudden you've got yourself a revelation in Johnny Boychuk. A guy who was third banana, fourth banana on that Bruins team, now all of a sudden sitting first chair with the New York Islanders and putting up crazy numbers. So he's going to get a nice reception tonight in Boston, and rightfully so. They love him there. They miss him there. Chiarelli, he got torched in the Boston Globe a little bit today because of the Boychuk thing. I still think he's a fine general manager, and I still think he's doing what he can to keep this team together. Now, the real question then becomes whether the Bruins are past their expiration date, whether he's desperately trying to keep something together that maybe needed a little bit more turnover. There's a lot of names on this team. A lot of names on this team that were there and etched on the cup when Boston won it. And I know that they've been the argument for consistency of roster for many years. Adam Oates with the Capitals swore by it. Basically kept the Caps team together for 2 years in a row, citing the Boston Bruins and consistency of roster. They made the Sagan trade, bought in Louis Erickson. That's nice. But for the most part, it's a slew of younger players coming in through the lineup, supplanting older ones. So we'll see. It's a fascinating thing to be able to kind of look down the road, courtesy of places like CapGeek, and see, oh yeah, next season, Gregory Campbell, Riley Smith, Carl Soderberg, Tory Krug, Adam McQuaid, Dougie Hamilton, all up. It almost makes you wonder whether he should have kept Boychuk. You know, go all in this season. Go roll your dice with that defensive group. Because you're going to have to make difficult decisions beyond Johnny Boychuk next summer, too. I don't know. That's why he gets paid the big bucks. Coming up, Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch will join us to talk about, well, all that stuff happening in Columbus. Nathan Horton's career maybe being over. The healing process with Boone Jenner. The revelation that is Nick Foligno this season. And just what it's been like the year after the breakout year for that franchise. And then Jen Lutkastella will join us. Who? You know her as Regressed PDO on Twitter. You know her as Jen LC. And you shall know her as the stats maven of Puck Daddy. She'll join us here for the first time on the podcast as well. With that, let's start the show proper, shall we? We start the Greg Wyshynski Show proper, shall we?
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Well, again, listen, you're one of my favorite guests. I appreciate you coming on the program.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Dude, I know. Listen, I wish I could spend like a full hour or more on the podcast.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Phil Coker makes a good point about Dean Lombardi that I didn't consider, but it's a really good answer. Lombardi's done it because he's still capitalizing on old contracts like Carter's and Richards that dramatically reduce cap hit. There's books to be written about the team building that Lombardi's done in L.A., about the patience he showed for many years while Doughty and players like him were maturing, and about the aggressive way he went after guys like Richards and Carter when they became available. I mean, don't forget, man, you know, Wayne Simmons, pretty damn good hockey player now. You know, Jack Johnson, despite not being, you know, patriotic enough to represent us in Sochi, damn good hockey player. He's, in many ways, Lombardi's become the model, I think, for what we wanted of a GM. A guy who is going to be responsible with the young talent coming through the system, but bold enough to pull the trigger when the time is right. And utilizing young assets to do so. Balancing, sacrificing the future for going all in now. Now, granted, we still probably are a little bit on the fence on that Jonathan Quick contract. Because goalies is why. But, I mean, as far as him pulling off stuff and making stuff happen, I mean, mad respect for the guy. Playing with sticks. In my opinion, Doug Wilson should get more heat for not building a team that can win in the playoffs after 11 years. That's a good point, and I think now the heat on Wilson really is about some of the contracts he's given out that have handcuffed the team. I mean, he deserves to get grief for not being able to for going in front of microphones after the season, putting his you-know-what on the table and saying, we're going to make some major changes. Oh, except for the fact that I've handcuffed myself and I can't make any of those changes. Doug Wilson's he's a good example of a guy who I think has passed the point of getting a pass. He's a good example of someone whose expiration date might have passed, especially if the Sharks don't do it this year. But of course they will, because I didn't pick him. Joining us now on the line, one of my favorite beat guys in all the land, a man who, despite being behind some weird paywall now, I still find a way to read. He is Aaron Portsline. He writes the Puck Rakers blog on Columbus Dispatch and, of course, covers the team on the beat. Aaron, why can't your website allow me to read all of the things that you write anymore?
I wish you say you find a way to read things behind the paywall. Could you maybe explain that a little bit without?
I am not going to – listen, if the Columbus Dispatch wants to hire me as a hacker and allow me to show them the holes in their game by all means. But listen, I know I'm costing you money. I'm not going to allow the entire listenership to cost you money too, but I'm doing it because it's part of my job.
Well, you're living proof that good journalism is not free.
This is very, well, yes, that's right, because this podcast is so subscription based.
Yeah,
no, but exactly. listen, there's always gonna, speaking about journalism for a second, I understand why paywalls exist. I am very happy that they exist because I want people like you to be able to continue to do great work and get paid and keep jobs and the whole thing. I just think in a lot of ways the horse has left the barn. Like, if everybody had gotten together on paywalls when the web exploded circa 2006, 2007, we'd be in a different place right now. I just think at this point, people are always going to find a way to find that information, and I don't know if it's as effective as maybe the overlords at newspapers think it is.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. That's the conundrum. It's how many people are we losing by charging? And the numbers that are your hits, of course, dictate your advertising. So when you chase some of those people away by charging for content, does the money that you earn from people who do subscribe, does it offset the numbers that you lose through advertising? And there are people far smarter than I who have done those. You might call them advanced stats. You might. this is what they've arrived at. Several newspapers are going this way. The hope, the demand really is that as a newspaper, if you are committed to traveling with the club, putting two beat writers full time on the team, that you will have information that is presented professionally, and also, because you've been at it for a while, access that is used in your reporting that other places can't quite achieve. And whether we do that or not, I guess that's up to the people who decide if they want to pay for it. But this is something, and we shouldn't go on this too long, but this is something that will shock people, and it speaks, I think, to the fan base of the Blue Jackets. Our Blue Jackets blog, and I say our, it's not just me, Sean Mitchell, Michael Arace all contribute. Most months it does three or four times the traffic that the Ohio State football blog does. Just think about that for a second. That's the marketplace we're in.
And your last point, I think, is the important point, and it's something that on our blog, even though our blog is not a pay model, that we've stressed, which is that the more original content that you can create, and original commentary you can create and analysis you can create, that's not simply just regurgitating the things that are out there already, the more you become invaluable, and the more people will seek you out and consider you a daily part of their consumption. And in your case, and I'm assuming this is the case, I mean, you are the Blue Jackets beat. It's a one newspaper town I don't know the complete dynamics of it, but I see it as a one newspaper town. If a place in Toronto tried to do a paywall, I think they might get laughed out of the city because you have 17 other outlets covering the Leafs, including the Leafs themselves. Right. But in your case, if you want real Blue Jackets coverage that's not going to be state-run media, you come to Puckrakers. And I think that's a great position to be in, especially if you're looking for people to pony up for it.
Yeah, I won't refute any of that. And I do appreciate the situation that I'm in, that we're in. As a paper. But I think it's a reasonable price. It's not gouging, I don't think. I mean, it's cheaper than getting the newspaper used to be, right? I do wonder if there could not be like an a la carte type package where you could get just this or just that for a certain price.
That's a great point, because I know as a consumer, I would gladly pay for your Ryan Johansson contract stories and your Nathan Horton end of career stories, but I really don't care about your fourth line, left wing stories.
Dude, Adam Cracknell's in tonight.
let's get to the big stuff. That you've been reporting on Horton now for a bit. The last story was extraordinarily dire about the potential for his career to be over because of this back injury. Now, Jarmo Kekäläinen has been saying for many moons, this is just the normal thing that people go through when they play hockey. But it sounds like maybe it's a bit more severe than that.
Yeah, it's quite a bit more severe than that. And I think at some point every hockey player, regardless of level, does have back issues. You can only get a tree limb in the lower back so many times before your back roars up on you. This is a degenerative situation with his lumbar region of his spine, which is the lower back, which means that every aspect of his lower spine has degenerated. Okay. And so, you know, it's not just a disc where they can go in and fix it and he misses 6 months. I'm not making light of that either. This is not a single element that can be fixed. This is a debilitating injury for anyone, much less a hockey player. And talking to some of the players yesterday after our story came out, they're saddened, and, you know, they're pretty emotional about it. And Nick Foligno among them saying that he can't even play with his kids right now. That's the pain that he is in. So he has not skated since his last game with the Blue Jackets last April. And he's resting it right now. He's almost certainly out for this season. And it's very, very possible that at 29 years old, his career is over.
Yeah, that's so sad. How do they address this season? I mean, assuming that they're going to write off this season with Horton, will they seek to replace him with another player in his mold, or how do they address it?
Yeah, I think they will. I know that they've tried. And when I say tried, I don't think it was we've got to get something done type conversations. I think it was, I know it was, exploratory phone calls around the league. What are you looking at? What have you got? What do you need? These are conversations that GMs have frequently. Sales calls, if you will. But I think you have to look at it this way, too. This Blue Jackets team achieved what they did last season, stayed in the race, made the playoffs, played a pretty competitive first round with Pittsburgh without Boone Jenner. Or I'm sorry, without Nathan Horton. And it's because of the play of Boone Jenner, of Brandon Dubinsky, these guys. They need these guys to get back into the lineup. Dubinsky and Jenner are both out probably another month. When they come back, I think you'll see a team similar to the competitive level of last year's team when Nathan Horton was either out of the lineup or only a fraction of himself in the lineup, still coming back from the shoulder injury. So I think they get those guys back. They see where they fit. They also added Scott Hartnell in the offseason. So that's another forceful type top six forward. And when they get a better measure of that, I am convinced that Jarmo Kekalainen is going to try to add to their top six. I think it would be reckless at this point to start throwing out names because I think the landscape is going to change between now and that time. But I would not be surprised to see Jarmo be aggressive either before the trade deadline or certainly at it.
Last one on Horton. I mean, I know that they're different ailments, obviously. But there was some concern about his fragility when he was signed long term. Does any of this come as blowback to Jarmo, or is this a situation where you just can never tell what's going to happen to a player's back?
Yeah, well, I think that's a fair question to ask. And Nathan Horton had back injuries, or back issues, I should say, while he was with the Bruins, discomfort. But I think you can take any blame away from the Blue Jackets or Kekalainen just from the simple fact that the Bruins really wanted to re-sign Nathan Horton. If you remember the great video clip of Chiarelli being devastated when informed by Paul Kropelka that Horton was leaving and going to Columbus, they wanted him back. Now, that's the team that had a full scope and a full understanding of his medical situation better than anybody other than maybe Horton himself. And they wanted the player back. They would have gone long-term. I think that right there is proof that the Blue Jackets were not reckless, that this is not a matter of them ignoring a serious health issue and signing the player. Anyways, I think it's just a very unfortunate turn of events. And there have been other guys who have retired at a very young age. Mike Bossy was, 30 years old, 31 maybe, when he retired with a back injury. These things do take a turn. And it must be said, they've not given up on this. They've not written off Horton, period. Backs are strange, and some people have had this situation, and at some point the pain alleviates and they're able to play. The question is, for a player like this, if pain does alleviate, I can't imagine there are any doctors that would say, yes, I suggest you go play hockey now. Right. It would be up to the player at that point. Right. But this is a very tenuous, time. And I think it's just an unfortunate turn of events.
Well, if there is a silver lining to any of this, it's that Nick Foligno has gotten a shot on the top line and has played really well. Did you have an inkling that if given the opportunity, he could do this sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't know that he's a perfect top line winger. I think so many times that, you know, there's always the one player on each line that is sort of the interchangeable part. And they love Jenner next to Johansson. So who's on the opposite side? It very well could be Foligno. It could be Hartnell. Who knows? Foligno's an interesting guy because he is an unrestricted free agent. To my knowledge, there have been absolutely no contract talks with him about an extension. That's not alarming at this point, of course, but he is a player that I think they would really regret letting leave because he does so many things. He can play anywhere on the wing in that top nine and is an effective player, stretches the ice with his speed, is combative, is confrontational, great forechecker, can kill penalties, and he's a pretty good scorer, career high in goals last year. There seems to be a feeling that the surface, the ceiling for Nick Foligno is still just up there a little bit higher, that he can do a little bit more, and certainly in a contract year, he would love an opportunity to show that.
In a way, is it good that all this adversity visited this team in October? Because I imagine they come off of last year feeling pretty damn good about life with the six-game series against the Penguins, making the playoffs, everybody kind of kissing their ass a little bit about being a team on the rise. Is it good to have adversity visit this early?
You know, I don't think it's a bad thing. Nobody would choose it, obviously. And, you know, God, Dubinsky and Jenner and Murray out of their lineup, everyone's got injury woes at some point. Those are three really crucial pieces to this team. But, I look back at last year, and they were kind of sailing in choppy seas, and Bobrovsky looked okay. And then he hurt his groin in early December, and everybody thought the roof was going to cave in, myself included, because now Curtis McElhinney is your guy. And that team that had been sort of wandering and not quite tight and together on the ice, looked like there were three different systems being played some nights, that really galvanized them. I'm very interested to see what happens on this California trip. This is a huge test for any team, but to play San Jose, Anaheim, L.A. three times in four days, this is going to be, I think, very, very revealing. If they get 2 points out of this, it's okay. If they get three, I think it's been a good trip. They're moving rookie Alex Wennberg into the middle. That is a look at the depth of down the middle with these three teams. It's incredible. That's going to be a really tall order for Alexander Wennberg. But there's lots that's being discovered here. And I do think it's galvanized this team, but it's devastating to take that many sort of foundational players out of the lineup at once. This team doesn't have a captain, and now many of their leaders, de facto captains, if you will, Jenner, Dubinsky, they're out of the lineup too and unable to make an impact in any way.
Two more for you. First off, you mentioned some Western Conference teams, and I'm always revisiting the fact that the Blue Jackets have the benefit of trying to find their way in the East, which I imagine is quite beneficial to them.
Yes.
It
is. They get tired of answering the question to the point where I think they've told them not to talk about the East. It is absolutely night and day. And as a guy who spent the first 12 years covering a Western Conference team, you come to the East, the style of play I don't even pretend to explain why, but the style of play is so much lighter, freewheeling. There's less confrontation for space on the ice. When you play Western Conference teams, the top 10 of them anyways, it is so confrontational, so physical. This team, Columbus, opened the season with Buffalo and the Rangers, and both of these games were kind of like hot chocolate skates, if you will, where they're just lollygagging up the ice, all kinds of space. Let's try it. Oh, this didn't work out. Okay, well, then they have to fuck now. They'll try it. Oh, that didn't work out. And then Dallas came to town, and it took the Blue Jackets the better part of the first period to get on top of the treadmill that was going. It's a totally different game. A totally different game. And the Stars are a good team, not one of the top three, four teams in the West. And they totally set the pace. And it was almost a reminder to the Blue Jackets of what the Western Conference style is. And what was troubling about that is they have tried desperately to be a Western Conference team in the Eastern Conference. And they are on guard about against letting that slip. So for me, these kind of trips here are really good for them. It's a reminder of who they were supposed to be, what they want to be, and it's absolutely night and day, the styles.
When you said hot chocolate skates, I was wondering if you were referring to Tyler Ennis and Matt Zuccarello as being mini marshmallows. But obviously, that's not where you were going.
No,
I was thinking of
like the Columbus Zoo public skates on Christmas.
I know.
Where people have their stockings and holes.
Everybody. Oh yeah. Hey, listen. Yeah, I lived in Virginia for a long time. The Reston Town Center used to have You know, their little ice sheet that they'd put up around holiday time was the best. Finally, sir.
Yeah.
What give us for all of us that don't live in the great city of Columbus, but will of course be visiting there for the All-Star game? What's the vibe in the city? Did everybody come? Did the fans come back re-energized? Have they increased the bandwagon at all coming into this season? As far as what happened in the playoffs last year, is there more talk about the Blue Jackets now than we've seen before?
Not more than I've seen before, but more than I've seen in a long time. The level of excitement for this team when they first came to town was off the charts and something that I'll never forget. What happened in the years that followed, the Arneil years, the Housen years at the end, when so many people just, it wasn't only that the team was losing. It was the fact that they were losing, and on too many nights there was not a clear sign that they gave a damn about losing. What changed just in the last year, and they chased a lot of people away from the building. It wasn't people that said, I'll come back when they're better. It's people who just frankly said, I can't do this anymore, and I don't care anymore. I don't follow them anymore. They're just not of interest to me. And they love hockey, so they're there, but you got to get them back. And last year's team it was really even the team before that with Dubinsky. This guy, Jack Johnson, the way he came here and handled it, but Dubinsky took it to another level. I will fight for this team. We are going to do things here. People rallied behind that. Here's a team that maybe isn't good enough skill-wise, but they care, and they play like they care. And that really started to come through, and that really resonated with people in Columbus. It's an interesting city. It's stuck between Cleveland and Cincinnati, and it is the anonymous city of those three. Yet it is bigger than Cleveland, and it is bigger than Cincinnati combined by more than 200,000 people. It is a huge, growing city that is still cranking out jobs and is still growing, the only Ohio major city that's still growing. There's a sense that it's time for the city to step up and to be a major league city, to not be Browns fans and Bengals fans, Reds fans and Indians fans, but to be Blue Jackets fans, and to have fans in Cleveland and fans in Cincinnati be Blue Jackets fans, be fans of a team in Columbus. That has not happened before outside of Ohio State football. They're really into this team. There is a sense of pride and connection that I think is similar to places like San Jose, another city that's lived in the shadows of bigger cities around it. And I still think they're only scratching the surface here, that the city loves what it knows so far, but it still doesn't quite have an understanding of how great this can be when this team finally reaches that level of annual playoff runs, of rivals, of having teams that hate it, legendary teams not like it. To be in that conversation would mean everything to the city.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Great stuff, Aaron. And I still don't know why you need a paywall when you're getting all that money from the Department of the Chamber of Commerce in Columbus for soliloquies like that. But
I want to know your trick, you. There might be charges pressed, thankfully. Publicly, you've acknowledged stealing, have you not?
No, it's not stealing, sir. It's borrowing. I'll give you the content back.
My lawyers will be contacting you.
Well, get in line. All right, Aaron. I will talk to you soon, man. And great stuff and continued success covering the Jackets.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
There you go. Aaron Portsline, ladies and gentlemen, the great beat writer for the Columbus Blue Jackets. To further his point, first off, Columbus is going to have a great coming out party with this All-Star game. It's a fantastic city. It's a great hockey town. It's a great drinking town. It's one of those places that the All-Star game exists, ladies and gentlemen, not for me or you or anybody who tunes in on a television to watch the game. The All-Star game exists for the people that attend the All-Star game and for the city that hosts it. You know, it's a chance to go see all the pretty awards from the NHL, the traveling Hall of Fame roadshow. It's a chance to pay money and feel closer to these players than you've ever felt before, whether you're a fan or a sponsor or whomever. It's a chance to feel like you're part of the greater hockey community when maybe you don't always feel like that in Raleigh, or don't always feel like that in Atlanta, RIP, or don't always feel like that in Columbus. And I think the All-Star game, Columbus is the perfect market for the All-Star game, and it's going to be a real party there. And the second thing is, you know, 'twas a time in this league after the lockout when they started giving away outdoor games like candy on Halloween. I know they don't do it all that much anymore. We're only getting, one this year outside of the Winter Classic. But put the Blue Jackets and the Penguins at Ohio State. Do it now. Do it right now. As much as everybody's got their hockey boner for the Penguins and Flyers at Penn State, which I would love to see happen, and Lord knows last night's game was another indication that these two teams just generally don't like each other. Columbus and Pittsburgh have a burgeoning, wonderful rivalry, and it would be an amazing moment to watch the Penguins fans invade OSU and Blue Jackets fans trying to battle them back by buying all those tickets for an outdoor game there. Oh, it'd be the best. So that's something that the NHL really does need to make happen. And it's just another example when we talk about these outdoor games. This is another example that we have many more dance cards that need to be punched before we can say that we've outgrown the gimmick. There's a lot of other stadiums around this country and matchups that we have yet to see that need to be exploited by the NHL and their outdoor game series before we can really be like, oh, outdoor games, I'm so blasé about that. Oh, shut up. They're great. Jen LC coming up in a second or two. Also, get in, if you want, at Wyshynski yet on Twitter and Puck Daddy Blog on Yahoo.com. I want to do a few more mailbag things that we didn't get to yesterday. There isn't really a pressing question of the day anyway. You know, what are we going to do? Oh, is Ovechkin really a coach killer? Join us now for our fake hot takes. I mean, there's really no, thing that I was all that worried about. I mean, coach's challenge we talked about yesterday, it's obvious we need it. You know, which of the Oilers players do you think will get traded? Well, you know, Yakupov's the guy who'll probably get traded. Eberle's the guy that would bring back the most return. Nugent Hopkins untouchable because you're not going to trade a center. And Taylor Hall's a legit star. There. Problem solved. All right. Joining us down the line, I'm thrilled to have her, both as a guest in this podcast and also as a member of the Puck Daddy team. She is Jen Lute-Castella. You know her better as Jen LC on the Twitters, repressed PDO, regressed, sorry, PDO is the handle.
Regressed to whatever.
Repressed, you regressed. Know. Well, I mean, you know, being a woman in hockey writing, obviously you're repressed. We all know that, so right. You know, we'll just do that anyway. Jen joined us now on the podcast, and super happy to have you. Your first article will be soon. People have been asking me, and you know, Yahoo's HR department fumbles and bumbles sometimes, and evidently this is another one of those situations. But you're writing for us soon. It wasn't just like a phantom hiring. And
I am real.
You are real. You're very real. For those who – I mean, if you want to give a little thumbnail bio about yourself, how you got involved in all this hockey stuff?
Sure. I'm a lawyer, which, every other – analytics blogger ever, and decided to take some time away from the career to focus on my kids, and they went to school, and I started messing around with hockey analytics, because who doesn't just do that in their spare time? And I don't know, I think it was like November of 2013, so 11 months ago, I wrote an article about a player on the Blackhawks who I thought could do more for the team and, you know, kind of change up his usage and stuff, and thought no one would read it, and everyone liked it. So it kind of took off from there, and here I am now. Look at me.
There you are. What
big time hanging out with you guys.
Oh, you are big time. What is the, and you're going to analytics conferences too, which we'll get to later on. What was the real sort of come to Jesus moment when it came to hockey stats though? I mean, obviously you're a hockey fan, you're following all the points, assists, goals, everything. Was there one metric, one number, one analysis that you did or read where you said, okay, I get this. This stuff is valuable, and it's telling me more about this team than I ever noticed before.
You know, maybe it was more of a lack thereof. It might have been the thing. I followed a lot of super smart, and still do follow a lot of super smart people on Twitter, read their articles on their blogs and everything, where they were not only taking all of the stats that were used and explaining them and doing neat things with them, but they were then, you know, applying it to different teams. And I started looking for that for the, you know, with the Blackhawks, and I was having a really hard time finding it. I could find some here and there, but I couldn't find something where I could just go to every day and, you know, see some numbers or check it out. And I thought, if no one else is going to do this, I'm just going to write this article and no one will care and whatever. But then it just kind of took off, because there just wasn't a whole lot out there about the Blackhawks. Other than, I know Sam Fells had done some stuff, and some of the people at the Committed Indian, and that's where I was finding, you know, little bits here and there, but I just couldn't find a very big, you know, bulk or volume of analytics type of writing about Chicago.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. And they're a good team to analyze too, obviously, for various reasons.
Yeah, they're
reasons.
All right. I mean, yeah. They're pretty good, I guess.
The analytics stuff's fascinating. I mean, obviously, every time we bring it up on this show, there's debates that rage on both sides, as far as people who think they're overvalued and people that believe that they are the truth teller in professional hockey. Are you now deeply sighing and shrugging shoulders when you do see people speak out against analytics and kind of bemoaning the hiring of people and saying, you know, it's too early to tell whether Corsi and Fenwick really can tell us anything? I mean, or where are you on that?
Most of the time, I'm just chuckling and laughing, because I tend to look at that stuff and just say, okay, we get it. You don't like it. You know, I understand. We've gotten the picture 100,000 times already. At this point, it feels like kind of just a shtick for some guys to come out and say, oh, analytics are garbage. I can tell everything about grit and heart and blah, blah, blah. And it's almost like they're doing it to get a certain portion of each team's fan base to be like, I like that guy. Enough with these, you know, young whippersnappers and all their numbers. You know, and I think I get some of it. I mean, I understand. We look at these players and they capture our hearts because we love the team and they do amazing things and they make us feel great when our team wins or when they do something awesome, like, you know, a terrific overtime goal or something. And you don't want to think that that's all reduced to just some formula on a paper. And it's really not. I don't think that's what stats people are trying to do. I don't think they're trying to take the romanticism out of hockey or something. They're just trying to say, hey, here's something you may have missed because you're focusing so much on your favorite player. You didn't notice that this other guy on his line is actually pretty good. Or here's how we could make his line better, and this guy's going to score even more goals, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or here's how we can predict who, you know, might be really good next season and who maybe just had a fluky, really good season, and you shouldn't be begging your team to sign this guy. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it's just a matter of perspective, really.
Do you think where we are in analytics and where we are as far as the data that we use and the stuff that we measure, Are we more effective in measuring teams for things like possession than we are players, or is there no disparity between the two?
I think that it's getting a lot closer. I think teams might be a little bit easier to measure just because, you know, maybe I should put it from the player perspective. Sometimes it's hard to break out what a player does and separate that completely from his team or from his line mates or from the guys he's on the ice with. And so sometimes we can get a little, you know, that can get a little bit of a gray area in it. So it's probably easier to look at it from a team perspective. But there's been some really neat stuff done in the past year or so, like DeCourcy trying to take the team effects out of it, just kind of look at how players are from a possession standpoint by trying to give them an even playing field. It's not to say who's the best player, who's the better player. It's to say DeCourcy kind of looks at it and says, here's what we expect from this guy, given all of these things, given his zone starts, given his line mates. Did he meet our expectations? Did he exceed them? Did he kind of fall a little bit short and go from there? So it's probably easier with teams, but I think we've made some real progress with the individual players too.
And that's really the interesting part of what's happening in analytics for me is that, you know, there are so many layers to peel before you get to the core of that onion, you know, and I was watching, I was reading some of people the other day talking about how, I think it was maybe Edmonton. Maybe it was somebody in a blowout loss talking about how they won won the possession battle overall in the game, because all they're doing is going and looking at the team Corsi for the game. And ignoring, well, at some point when you're getting blown out, the other team is playing a different style of hockey and allowing you to possess the puck more.
Score effects.
Yeah, score effects, exactly. But not only that, but like it just takes one more click of the mouse to go down to, you know, 5-on-5 close or something like along those lines when you're trying to find out how good they played when the score was tied or they were down by a goal. And it just seems like we've got a lot of people that are on the finally on board when it comes to analytics, but we don't have a lot of people that understand there are as many generalities in advanced stats as there are in the normal stuff.
Right. There's some fine tuning that you can definitely need to do when you're trying to understand it, but it is pretty neat to see people, you know, kind of getting a better grasp on it and learning about it. And that stuff comes with time. You know, the more you play around with this stuff, or the more you listen to people talk about it, or, you know, follow along in these conversations on Twitter and stuff where people are talking about, oh, score close or score adjusted Fenwick or something like that. The more you start to learn those little things that can change it up a little bit. But yeah, I know, you know, I think every game, like Chicago's game versus Calgary the other day, it was just hilarious because it was like, you know, some ridiculous possession numbers for the Blackhawks and they lost the game. And of course people chirped me afterward. They were like, yeah, where's your analytics god now, Jen, you know, and all that stuff. But I think people are getting it. There's, you know, not everybody's an expert on everything. So there's always a little room to grow.
Listen, you're on Puck Daddy now, so you have to be an expert on everything. I mean, everybody looks to us to be experts. As you know, we're all pundits.
We're going to need to talk about that.
Yeah, we're pundits. We're experts. We know everything. We talk down to everybody, according to our critics as well. So that's always a thing.
I'm really not built to be like that stuck up. I'm going to have to work on this.
Don't worry. I mean, I think I'm pretty much the lightning rod for all of it. Well, no, me and Lambert will catch all the lightning, and you and Leahy and Josh can all kind of exist in your own happy place, and we'll be the ones
to
take all the grief. But I will put you on the spot right now. Can you put you on the spot
now? Okay, I'm ready.
Give me an example of a player who you think is overrated vis-a-vis the stats they put up in normal stat land and what the analytics tell us they do in terms of possession and effects on teammates and things like that.
Oh boy, let's see here.
Is there anybody that you've sort of a whipping boy for you when it comes to that sort of thing? An example of maybe we all see him one way, but when you break down the numbers, we see him another way? Could be even somebody on Chicago if you want.
See, of course, I always expect to like talk about the underrated guys, and then you guys ask me about the overrated guys.
Because we're completely negative and cynical.
Let me think for a second here. Who do you guys have in that? Do you have anyone that you think?
No,
really...
I don't know. I mean, sometimes I'll look at the numbers and I'll see someone who, you know, I think is a pretty effective player, but then all of a sudden I see what the players do when they're not with them. And that typically is on defense, you know, guys that maybe, you know, and I think defense is where possession is a really interesting thing to measure, is because sometimes you're dealing with pairs, right? I mean, you're always dealing with pairings, and there's always going to be one guy that carries the freight for the other guy. I was looking at that with Boychuk and when he played with Chara, for example. I mean, you know, he was a pretty effective player with or without him. But when it came to Barkowski, for example, he was a different player when he wasn't playing with Boychuk last season. So that kind of thing was what I was looking for.
Maybe, I don't know. I'm trying to think of like a big name who was a big deal. Maybe Ryan Callahan.
Interesting. Why is that?
He's had, you know, I mean, he'd signed that big deal at Tampa Bay and everything was, you know, and he's not a bad player by any means. I just don't think he's kind of the, you know, the golden god that some may think that he is. I've just never been particularly impressed with his possession numbers, and it's not like he makes his teammates that much better. Type of thing. I think he's more along for the ride than he is a real driver of possession. Like, he'll do about as well as his teammates do when they're out there, but I don't think he's a real possession driver. So maybe Ryan Callahan, and I'm picking on him, of course, because he's kind of a big name and got a lot of money. Brooks Orpik. I mean, there's an easy one.
There
he makes a ton of money. He's a defenseman, I know, but he is an absolute, you know, like, anchor on possession. Although I will say, I did try and bail him out the other day because that John Scott goal wasn't totally his fault. So I don't think I'm just picking on him because of that. There were other players at fault too there, but, you know. And John Scott obviously is just a sniper. What are you going to do?
And with blazing speed, nonetheless, too. Well, you picked on
speed, that guy, and those
you picked
hands.
On two. You picked on two players that have an amazing amount of heart and grit as well, which I think is speaks volumes as well as far as their perception
you.
For
I
some
mean,
people.
You know, I really don't think Callahan is a bad player by any means. I just don't think he's quite as amazing as some people may think.
This is true, Jen.
Come at me, haters.
Yeah, exactly. For your hot take. I hope the hot takery was listening to this interview and puts your hot take on that side. Well, tell us about this analytics conference coming up for you.
Yeah, War on Ice is doing their stat site, and they're doing an analytics workshop in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon University on November 8th. And they asked me to speak there, so I'm going to give a little spiel. And it should be fun. They have a lot of fun nerds going there. So it should be a good time. And it's open to everyone to come. And I don't think there's any cost for it. I think it's just like a donation to cover snacks and stuff. Mm.
You will be tasked to define Fenwick Close. There's going to be there should be at least some sort of entry exam into this thing at some point.
An entry exam? So you can just come and heckle.
Exactly.
I think there are a couple people just coming to heckle, so that's good.
We look forward to the Steve Simmons run-in at some point where he throws the doors open and walks down the aisle and starts accusing you all of heresy.
Oh my gosh, it would be so great. I would enjoy it so much.
All right,
and not
Jen.
In like a mean way, just like a, oh look, I've made it type of way.
Well, Jen, we are honored to have you at Puck Daddy, and by that I mean we're shocked you haven't been hired by a team.
Stop. You guys are great. Thank you.
But your debut will be coming soon. Everybody will read it and love it, and thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
There you go. Great, Jen LC.
Okay. Have a great day.
Regressed PDO as opposed to repressed PDO on the Twitters. And there she goes. Thanks, Jen. So yeah, she's awesome, and she's gonna start writing soon. There's a little bit of a, I talked to my editor in Canada, and he said something about like a background check or something that had to happen from HR. HR is HR exists to sometimes put as many obstacles as they can in front of you before you go and sign contracts or hire people, which is weird because you'd figure it'd be the other way. Here is a mechanism that exists to get you new contracts or new people signed. Instead, sometimes there can be obstruction on a 95 devil's level. How about some questions from the audience? Matt, do you have the Going Postal sounder you could play just to get everybody in the mood for it? No, it's in 20 seconds, he says. I'm kidding. I'm not going to do Girl from Ipanema if Jeff's not here to comment on it. By the way, I'm surprised I haven't... Oh, go ahead. Do it then.
Do you want to do a mailbag segment every week?
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyshynski. Not that deep.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog at yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Wonder if we should do this every day and just scrap the QOD. I don't know. Oh yeah, because you know all those production pieces you create for the show are really taking up entirely too much of your day. Mark Cole, by the way, wanted my take on the Avengers trailer, and I'll give it. I was about to say before we hit the sounder, it's amazing that I haven't talked about the Age of Ultron trailer already, considering Merrick's not here. But real briefly, everything I've heard about this film from people that are on the inside of things is incredible. It's going to take everybody to a really dark place. Scarlet Witch is Elizabeth Olsen's character in the movie. And if you don't know what she does, she is a witch. I mean, she literally creates these fantasy scenarios in people's minds to help, you know, brainwash them and convince them to do bad things. And I think you're seeing at least a couple of those in the movie trailer. I'm sure that there's some chicanery on that level that's making Hulk and Iron Man fight and having Iron Man put on the geek-gasmly awesome Hulkbuster armor. The ballerina scene that we see in the trailer, I'm pretty sure is going to be something that's happening inside of Black Widow's mind. It's a pretty effective trailer. Now, the two things I will say about it on the cautious side, one, it looks like more big city destructo, which we already got in the first one, and hopefully that's not the case. Two, I love James Spader, and I think he's going to kill it as the voice and the mocap of Ultron. And I do like the fact that they made Ultron's face a little bit more human than buggy, for lack of a better term. But there were a couple of times in that trailer where that voice veered a little too close to Heath Ledger territory for my liking. Right in the beginning when he's talking about, you know, you don't want to change things, you want to protect things or protect the status quo. It's a little bit too close to it for me. But I do love that concept, by the way, which is something that carries over from the Winter Soldier, which is the idea of, you know, protecting people, protecting the status quo. But are we really affecting change? Are we really changing the world, using our abilities to change mankind? Or is it even a hero's responsibility to do so? If a hero tries to exert his or her influence on mankind like that, are they really a hero or are they a conqueror? Which is a thing that's always been visited in Superman. I don't know. I don't like grimdark for Marvel movies all that much, especially after Guardians. But I think that if anyone's going to pull it off, it's Joss Whedon. Because Lord knows on Buffy, he was able to mine some pretty dark territory while also adding a little bit of levity to it. So there's your Age of Ultron take. I have watched the trailer 17 times, and I'm really intrigued by it. Ricardo writes in, I've been hearing a lot of comparisons between Crosby and McDavid and how they are franchise players. However, let's say Buffalo drafts him, which will probably happen. Do you think McDavid will have the same amount of success that Crosby had without having a Malkin on the second line? Do you believe Connor is that good that could fit a whole franchise, lift a whole franchise by himself? That's a really good question. I mean, I think that Crosby's a different kind of example. I mean, obviously he's a stellar player, and I would imagine McDavid's going to have the same sort of impact that Crosby had statistically in some ways. But in order to become a great team, what did Crosby needed? Well, he needed Malkin, Letang. He needed a franchise goalie. Say what you will about Fleury, but he's a franchise goalie behind him. He needed a lot of other elements, and that's going to really be the challenge for anybody who drafts McDavid is, you know, he's going to lift you a certain way, but you need to surround him with the right players to lift it even farther. And, you know, it took a while for, you know, for Ovechkin to get the Capitals rocking and rolling. Stamkos at San Luis. So it's a fair point that your savior is only going to do so much for you if you don't have someone to play second fiddle. And you need someone to play second fiddle in this league for sure. So it's a good point by Ricardo. And B, please ask Jen the brand and color of her nail polish. Jen, if you're still listening to the show, please tweet out the brand and color of your nail polish to Ann B. Colin Waters, how many years away do you think the NHL is from hiring an outsider as a GM, a la the young MLB GMs like Theo Epstein and Andrew Friedman? Smart guy, hockey friend, hockey fiend, but not connected to any GM tree or anything like that. Will it ever happen? NHL front office jobs seem like the oldest old boy network club that ever did old boys clubs, so it seems like never to me. I think it could happen, but I think there's a better chance of a broadcaster getting that kind of gig, like Pierre almost did. And Pierre's a different kind of situation, obviously. He is sort of an old boys network kind of guy than anybody outside of hockey. I think in order for that to happen, it would have to be somebody outside of hockey who comes in to be an assistant GM or a director of player analytics or something along those lines, who then earns enough experience in that role to then become a GM elsewhere. I don't think they're ever going to hire anybody straight away from outside the game to take over a team. They're going to have to come in a traditional role, pay their dues, then move up the ladder is probably how it's going to work. Rivalries, this is Dan Kelly. Rivalries seem to be an important part of the NHL's marketing these days. We have geographically senseless divisions designed to keep certain rivalries alive. We see the term loosely defined every Wednesday night as Liam McHugh is forced to justify why a Kings-Red Wings matchup constitutes a rivalry. We all know the real rivalries that exist are Toronto-Montreal, Montreal-Boston, Jersey and the Rangers, etc. I'm curious what potential rivalries we might see down the road in the next 5 years or so. He thinks Colorado-Dallas, Columbus-Pittsburgh, to steal a little thunder from the Philly-Pittsburgh rivalry. Potential rivalries down the road. Well, we've talked about this in the show before, that obviously a lot has to do with playoff rivalries and playoff series starting rivalries. I mean, I think Columbus and Pittsburgh was a rivalry beforehand, but I think it's been jump-started by their playoff series last year and hopefully by the continued progress of the Blue Jackets going forward. But as far as like new rivalries being born, I don't know. I mean, the Colorado-Dallas one is a good one only because you're going to be dealing with two teams that I think are on the rise, but it really, I think it all depends on what happens in the postseason and how much of that carries over to subsequent seasons. Fred Forsberg asked a question that I will answer because Jeff's not here. Is Kiprios and Healy bickering and then people getting to vote on who bickered the best good television? Well, I like the social media element that Sportsnet had in that segment where people vote on who won the debate. But at the heart of it, it's forced banter, which is the worst thing. Why do you people listen to this podcast? Because Jeff and I don't do forced banter. When we have heat, we have real heat. The verses in the title is a joke. Because, you know, we agree with each other 70% of the time. But that 30% where we don't, you know what we hear from people? Why are mom and dad fighting? And I'm usually mom. Because it's good. It means it's real. It means that there's passion behind it. And that's what people want. And I find I find that, you know, the forced banter thing is something that I always found unpalatable on ESPN with that Vrachta show that's on every morning, First Take. And last night, revisiting the Healy segment on Ovechkin, it was just, it's, you know, it is what it is. Just, at least it wasn't them arguing against each other for the most part. It was just them kind of stating their points. The Healy thing bothered me because it was sloppy and stupid. It doesn't mean that he's the worst guy on television, as many people say. I think he's a decent guy. I think he sometimes can do good work. I just think he's one of these guys that falls into these tropes too often and doesn't do his homework and doesn't offer complete thoughts on things. I'm sorry, but if you're sitting there saying that Ovechkin's played for five coaches that have been fired by Ted Leonsis and Trotz is the fifth, the rest of your argument comes off as rather unsound, don't you think? Or when you start just throwing out numbers. Like, he made one good salient point, which is that Ovechkin's contract, to me, has been something that that's given him cover, and that maybe this is a guy, because of his makeup, that needs a carrot in front of him, and getting paid that money every single year without fail through 2020, whatever, is not the best thing for him and his career. I agree. I've argued the same thing. But the idea that because his mom is his agent, he's not getting sound advice about you should play better for your coaches. Agents aren't going to give a shit about that. They're going to say, hey, good on you. You scored 51 goals. Now I can help negotiate this other endorsement deal. Like, as if Alan Walsh was his coach, all of a sudden he's going to get a stern talking to about back skating. Give me a break. And I'm sorry, the point I made in the post stands. Glenn Healy is a friend of agents. He's an NHLPA shill. He's a guy who worked for the PA. He knows agents. The fact that Ovechkin went outside the system and had his mom negotiate his contract, there's no way you're going to convince me that isn't stepping out of line and isn't something he frowns upon as a PA guy. Finally, Marilee. Let's hope that's right. Firstly, love the show. I rarely have the chance to listen live, but today I'm within reach of computer and internet, and I don't have to go to work tomorrow, so I don't have to save you for my commute. Well, thank you. Greg, my dear man, your chili recipe, please. You've mentioned it on the show too many times, and I love me a chili, and you must share. Well, here's what I'll do. I'll post it on the subreddit, hopefully within the next 24 hours. I actually have to I had it written down on a piece of paper, and that paper was lost. So I have to kind of reconstitute it in my mind and get it all together. But here are the basic facts that you need to know about the proper bowl of chili. First off, you can use turkey. You can use beef. They're both effective. You need to crock pot it. That's what I use. And the key to good chili is depth of flavor. You need to have spice. You need to have sweet. How do I create sweet? Well, I use a little thing called ketchup. And squirt some ketchup in there and taste. I use a little thing called sugar. Towards the end of the chili process, I will take my sugar pourer, which is, you know, what you'd find in a diner or at a coffee shop, and I will turn it upside down and I will give it a few swirls. But I also throw in, for depth of flavor, something, a little trick that I learned from the best dive bar in Northern Virginia. If you live in Northern Virginia, you know what I'm talking about, the Vienna Inn. The best chili dogs on God's green earth are at the Vienna Inn. And I did a story on them once, and I found out that the secret to their chili, ladies and gentlemen, the secret to it, the reason it tastes so good, it's so addictive, it gives you such a lift. Well, why wouldn't it give you a lift? It has a drug in it. A drug called caffeine. From the coffee grounds they put inside their chili. Coffee grounds go inside of Greg's Magic Bowl of Chili, too. I need to cook this. I don't know if it's this weekend or if it needs to just get a shade colder before it's the first time for chili. But, yeah, I'll try to post the full recipe there. It's peppers, beans, a whole bunch of other shit too, but that's the basics. Spicy and sweet, sugar, ketchup, coffee grounds. I've been known to throw a little cinnamon in there too. And then the heat usually comes from serranos or jalapenos, depending on what I'm feeling. And then also a specific hot sauce. Now that one, I'll keep to myself. Thank you to Aaron Portsline, who you got to hear on this show for free, as opposed to having to now pay for his opinions on the Columbus Dispatch's site. And Jen LC. Well, continue to call Jen LC, even though I know her last name and stuff, for joining us here on the podcast as well. She's awesome. I could not be. I have been trying to crack the code on getting somebody on analytics who could be someone who serves the smarts and allows the newbies to get what it is we're talking about. And Jen's going to hit that sweet spot perfectly. She's amazing. Follow her on Twitter at RegressPDO. Worthy of a follow beyond analytics. Also had some really amazing things to say about the Voinoff thing and other issues that involve gender in hockey as well. It's one of the reasons why I started following her in the first place. But she's great, and we couldn't be happier to have her on Puck Daddy. Two Jens now on Puck Daddy. We got a Neil, we got an LC, cornering the markets on people named Jen who write hockey. So if your name is Jen and you write hockey, be forewarned, we're coming for you. We've also cornered the market on guys named Sean Leahy, except for the guy who writes for USA Today, but we'll get him soon too. We want all the Jens and all the Sean Leahys in the world to work for Puck Daddy. That's the way it works. All right, it's the show. Thanks, Maddie. It's probably the longest I've ever gone solo, don't you think, Maddie? I don't know how that happened. It was probably... Might be the Ultron thing pushed a little bit longer than usual, but we'll be back Monday. I'm as mentioned yesterday, I will be attending Frozen on Ice tomorrow night or tomorrow afternoon with my daughter. So unless Jeff's rolling solo, I don't believe he would be because it is Game Show Friday. Why would he do that? We'll see you on Monday. Enjoy hockey, everybody, including don't forget the big return, the big matchup, James Neal versus the Pittsburgh Penguins coming up. In due time after the Predators and the Blackhawks face off this evening, which should be a fun one. And our own Josh Cooper has a really awesome feature coming up with James Neal on Friday on Puck Daddy, so do check it out. All right, that's enough. Bye.